Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hang in. Dude, there it is.
Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Hello, friends. I'm Charlie Hume, and I'm, of course, here with Smiley Kaufman, and we will get right to it with a breakdown of the Charles Schwab Challenge, where Emiliano Grillo gets his second PGA Tour win, first since 2015. Smiley, let's start right there. You were at Colonial Country Club all week long. A second straight week after we saw low scoring at the PGA Championship where a single digit number one. What did you see that Emiliano Grillo did well this week to win the tournament?
Yeah, well, first off, congratulations to Emiliano. He has always been considered to me a very good, great friend of mine. Somebody that I've always had a very good relationship with. We've played junior golf together. I've watched him grow up, and he's always been an incredible golfer. And he inspired me to win my PGA Tour event because he won the week before. And I was like, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And then we kind of battled that whole year in a rookie of the year race that he eventually won. And he played incredible golf. And it's crazy to me that he hasn't won more. He's had definitely some opportunities. If you would have asked me if in junior golf, who was going to win, you know, 10 times on the PGA Tour, I would have said that guy. I mean, his golf swing has always been one that you just watch and you said, this guy is so pure and he's got so much talent. I will say at the 18th hole, that was one of the crazier things I've ever seen, Charlie, with that ball in the, what was that? Just a waterway. And it's just,
I guess maybe a rain gutter of some sort and just the slow trickle back. And I was watching it without sound originally. So I was trying to kind of figure out, first of all, which direction the ball was rolling, because
it
rolling forwards? Because let's just see how far this thing goes. Can we get it right up next to the green? But of course it was going backwards, and the fans took great delight in tracking that thing all the way back until it finally stopped. But then, you know, has to take a drop and hit one off the cart path. And it actually looked like he had a good look in after that punch out, you know, with kind of a wedge there, but just hit it a little bit further past the pin than maybe he would have liked to, and ends up with a double.
Yeah, any way you slice it up, making a six when you got a two-shot lead is going to be one that if he didn't win, he would look back on and think, how in the heck could I not get it in five shots on that hole? Because you have a ton of room to hit it left. If you're not going to be able to get it on the green, but you can punch out. All you can't do there is hit it where he hit it. And so he was very lucky to survive Adam Schenck not making that putt on 18 because it was a very holeable putt. Then they get in the playoff, a couple of good looks. And then that 16th hole, I mean, he was a foot away from that ball ending up in the bunker. And that bunker shot would have been very difficult. And fun fact, I've actually made a hole in one on that hole at 16 and hit the same crap shot that Emiliano kind of hit. And you really are aiming kind of between that flag and the edge of the green, but he was further right of the edge of the green. He just kind of got a great kick, and that there's a tremendous amount of slope right to left and kind of back, and that ball funneled it right to about 5 feet. And you know, Schenck actually hit an incredible chip shot, by the way. That was a 10 out of 10 from that downhill slope.
Bump and run out of the rough there. The commentator said as we were watching it, just incredible stuff to get it as close as he did.
Oh my
because,
God.
You know, it's hard to not, you know, if you're going to play that shot, either get it caught up in the rough or do something where you land it too far and it's off the front of the green. So amazing stuff. But of course, Grillo makes the birdie there and ends the tournament on the second playoff hole.
We can get back to the golf course here. they had that play so firm and fast. For bent greens, they almost look brownish purple. You know, when you're looking at the green surfaces from the fairway, to me, there was no green in them. And when you see that in bent grass, you're thinking, oh my goodness. But when you walked on the surface, they were so firm and had just the you could see the imperfections because of it's almost like a waffle frying pan you put on the green, and that's seriously what your footmark looked like when you walked. So it was difficult conditions they played in. They had control of the golf course the entire week, the superintendent did, because we had zero rain, which made it to where they could do whatever they wanted with the place, and they made it play so hard because they're ripping it up tomorrow.
These are unusual conditions, right? Because it is not often that a golf course, you can push it to its absolute limits or even past its limits, because tomorrow morning, Gil Hanse and the Cavemen are coming in, ripping this thing up. And so you can, you know, there's really no need to try to have a balance there with the greens and making sure they don't get killed or, you know, get too dry, because, you know, it doesn't matter as of Monday morning.
Yeah, no, it was, they had it going, man. It was fun to watch a golf course play under 7,000 yards and have it play so difficult. The one guy that you look back at, it's like, man, Scotty's probably sitting there tonight, like, how the heck did I not win that tournament today? Thinking, like, I could have easily posted something around 9-10 under. And it was kind of the same thing that we've talked about with Scotty. He's hitting it unbelievable. And it's hard to discredit, you know, how successful he's been and how the amount of top 14 or 12s that he's had, 15 in a row now. And you don't want to dog the guy, but I just keep on wanting him to win so much more because he's hitting it at a level that we've never seen. Well, we have seen it, but we don't typically see.
Well, perhaps the biggest story of the week leading into it was a guy who was not around for the weekend. And that was, of course, Michael Block. This is a story that probably had 4, 5, maybe 10 cycles that have happened since the last time we discussed it on this podcast, recapping his amazing week at the PGA Championship. We had him earning the sponsor exemption into the Charles Schwab Challenge. We had an appearance on a podcast that was received maybe not so well in the golf media sphere. We had him going out and shooting 81 in his first round and eventually missing the cut and having some emotional post-round press conferences. A lot to get to here, but I'd start first with, you were part of the coverage of Michael Block's group on Thursday, and I just wonder what it was like being on the course with him and just taking in all that surrounded him.
Well, Charlie, if you would have told me 2 weeks ago that I was going to be at Colonial and following Michael Block around on the Thursday round, I would have told you were crazy. And I still feel that way. It's still just wild to me. The night before, I was expected to go with Victor Hovland. And then the next day, I was told I was going with Michael Block. And I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that. You know, a guy coming off of almost winning a major championship, and for someone like Michael Block, who nobody heard of until this past week, unless you were a total golf nut, for him to steal those headlines and to go on all this media tour. And, you know, the week obviously was storybook. And I don't think we'll ever really see anything quite like it, but I was there, and I'll tell you, the crowds for Michael were as big as I saw for Scottie Scheffler and on that Thursday. And by the end of the day, it had dwindled down a little bit. But on that back nine, pretty much any green that had the grandstands around it, you know, he was getting a pretty big ovation. And the golf for him that day, he was all over the place. I'm telling you, just, he wore his emotions on his sleeve. He looked like a guy that was just flat out exhausted. And you can question his game. You can question just kind of how he handled himself, the things he said. But from what I saw, he was a guy that had a, you know, he found lightning in a bottle. That's the only way to describe it for him, from what I saw with his golf game, to finish 15th in a major
It's incredible, really, because for what I saw, I saw some good stuff, but I didn't necessarily see 15th in a major. That means he did everything to the best of his ability. And we were talking earlier and about Michael's inability to hit it high or have all these shots. I know he's 46 years old, so we're not expecting him to be, you know, some 19, 20 year old who can hit it high and spin the ball, but still it was flat. It wasn't very high and it wasn't much spin. And I was seeing that all day. So, and that kind of goes into the major championship. How did he get it done? Well, he was second in driving accuracy at the PGA Championship and had a dream putting week. So hats off to him. The story was crazy. I mean, did you watch much of the coverage Thursday?
I did. I enjoyed your contributions as much as we were able
Thank
to
you.
Kind of stay. there were, I thought that there was, I think there was one line in particular where you were talking about, you know, the juxtaposition of Michael's week at Oak Hill versus, you know, he was in the midst of a really tough round on Thursday. And you said something to the effect of, you know, hey, you know, look at me. I was out on tour and now I'm here holding a microphone. And that's just how golf goes sometimes. And the thing to me that I thought was interesting watching Thursday's round is, and you noted the driving accuracy thing. And that's obviously, you know, if you hit the ball straight and in the fairway, even if you're hitting longer clubs, you're giving yourself a better chance to, you know, shoot a score, right? And when he wasn't doing that, and he was giving himself a lot of long clubs into those greens, you know, any person out there who thinks, who fancies himself as a scratch golfer, a plus handicap, who thinks, you know, hey, I could maybe get it done in a PGA Tour event, just go replay that round the Michael Block played, mm-hmm. because I can't even – there were so many times where I watched his approach shots hit the front of those incredibly firm greens and just roll all the way to the back or off the green. He's left with a, you know, a tough, sometimes short-sided chip. And to me, I think that's the it was a light bulb moment of sorts where you're like, the PGA Tour pros are playing a different game. The length they hit it, the height they hit it, the amount of spin they can impart on the ball when they need to. It's just these courses are set up for just a different sport, really. So I you know, and that's more on the golf itself piece, and I'd like to continue just on that train before we kind of diverge into some of the other stuff that happened around Michael this week. But from what you saw on Thursday, there were a lot of his, I guess you'd call him, his trademark theatrics of playing to the crowd and talking to people. Do you think that detracted from the golf that he was trying to play to do well in the tournament, or was it more of, he was already cooked at that point? He wasn't hitting the ball well, and he might as well kind of play to the crowd and try to enjoy it a little bit.
It's a good question. I definitely noticed the theatrics a bit. I think he was enjoying himself as much as he could, and I think that's why people like him, and I think he realizes I don't need to go into a shell out there, even though I'm playing bad, still try to, you know, enjoy the fans and enjoy playing at Colonial. He's never played there. He's always wanted to play there. So I guess if you look at it that way, he was just, you know, not playing good and figured might as well try to have a little bit of fun. But yeah, he did come up to me on the 13th hole and we made eye contact. He walked over, shook his hand, told him congrats. And he said, is there ever, you know, a time when you're playing golf where just nothing is going right? And I was like, yeah, man, like it happens so much out here. But I've said on coverage, like you said, yeah, I'm holding a microphone now. Of course I know that golf can go the wrong way. But, you know, what I was impressed with Michael, I think he's a good putter. I think he has the ability to hit it straight. He didn't hit it necessarily straight that day. He made comments saying he had a world-class short game on Bob Menery's podcast. And I didn't see that. And I saw some technique issues in his pitching. Personally, I thought he had a lot of, when I see a lot of dipping in the knees, to me, that's, you have to have a lot of timing and you're not able to have a ton of shots around the green. So I don't understand that take. Obviously every time when I was out there, if his ball was, you know, in the fringe where I would say 90% of the guys would pitch it, he brought the putter out, and I'm thinking that's kind of odd, you know, and then the one shot to see what his world-class short game was all about. He was in front of a bunker on 15, a very difficult shot I would say 9 to 10 out of 10 as far as difficulty. And he, I thought over it before he hit it, I said, he's either going to chunk this in the bunker or bone it over the green. And he chunked it in the bunker. Then he boned the next bunker shot over the green. And that's where it, the wheels were already off, but then they really started to fall off.
You noted the Bob Menery podcast, which is something that I want to get to, because I think that that was maybe one of the things that kind of set off the perhaps downturn or the turning on Michael Block in a lot of ways. But a couple interesting observations you made there that I want to kind of touch on, especially the nature of his short game, because I think the final highlight we have of Michael Block at Oak Hill is that up and down at 18.
Crazy good. Make the,
just incredibly good. And so I wonder from your perspective, the things you noticed about his short game, you know, is there, do you see other guys on tour now who have a home cooked short game that doesn't necessarily make sense, but works? And, you know, if that is the case, does that present like consistency issues where a guy can, in Michael Block's case, do it in a big moment when the pressure's on, just kind of make it work, even though you're looking at his technique and saying, I don't know if that's going to work long term. But then you kind of have a letdown week or come down week, you know, more accurately at Colonial, and he's lost the juice and he's already playing bad, and it's, and some of that stuff starts to break down and create issues.
The difference, I think, would be at Colonial, the times where I noticed that just the technique wasn't going to match up. It was from tight lies in the fairway. And when I saw him pitching well at the PGA Championship, it was at a rough, and it's a totally different deal. You can get away with a lot of your levels changing and your knees dipping and your chest kind of being back behind the golf ball, because you don't have to rely on that contact because of the heavy rough. So to me, the 18th up and down was insane for him, but it was on an upslope, and for him, that actually, the technique that he does have in his pitching, it actually sets up okay for him. But my mind was kind of spinning when you said which tour pro has a kind of a manufactured short game. And I couldn't come up with any, because pitching, you have to, it's the one part of your game. You know, we see different types of golf swings, how guys swing the golf club, but with pitching, there are some set of rules with pitching, and any golfer knows that you have to have clean contact and you can't chunk it. Your low point can't be behind the golf ball. So typically you don't really see a lot of different crazy stuff with the PGA Tour pros when they set up over a pitch or flop shot. That they're not going to have crazy loops in their pitching. It's going to be pretty on plane for the most part.
To come back to what you noted before, Bob Menery's Ripper Magoo podcast, side note, what a heck of a name for a podcast, Ripper Magoo. I was like, I don't know what the genre of this is. I don't know what we're doing here, but here we are. To sum up the quotes, which I'm sure everyone who's listening to this podcast, or the majority of people have already watched this clip or seen the quotes, the summation of them is basically, Michael Block says, if he could play from where Rory McIlroy hits his ball off the tee, he'd be one of the best players in the world. I just wonder what your take is on that, because it struck me as not a great thing to say, you know, coming off your kind of Cinderella story. But at the same time, it's like you probably don't get to where you are at the PGA Championship if you don't have some level of irrational confidence in your golf game.
I think so. I just think he was coming off. First off, he did 30 interviews. This is from when he finished the PGA Championship until when he teed it up on Thursday. He had done 30 scheduled interviews. That is an insane amount of media to do. And I imagine that by the end of that, or whenever that interview was, that you can probably feel pretty confident in yourself, because all these people are pumping you up and asking questions. I think there's no telling, you know, how tired he could have been during the interview, how, you know, because you're just discrediting how good Rory McIlroy is at the rest of his game. And I watch Rory week in and week out. You take, if he was an average hitter, it wouldn't matter. The guy's on, he's still an elite, you know, that's his superpower is how far he can hit it. But dude, he's an unbelievable iron player too. Like, let's not, if Rory had to hit it from where Michael Block hit it from, he'd beat the crap out of him. And I could tell you that confidently. So I, if the shoe was on the other foot, and if that question was asked to Rory, if you had to play from where Michael Bach played from, I'd say he could give him four or five aside and still feel pretty comfortable.
I wonder how that impacts Michael Bach going forward, because obviously he still has that Canadian Open exemption. And of course he's in the PGA Championship next year of Valhalla. And what you heard, at least at the beginning of the week or even at the PGA Championship, were a lot of tour pros who were loving the story, Rory included. Rory was genuinely touched by what went on in that final round.
We and all were.
Do those comments sour his perception amongst tour pros a little bit? Or I wonder if guys look at that and say, hey, man, I've done press conferences before or interviews where my words have gotten twisted a little bit. You know, maybe he didn't say it the best way, but I get what he was trying to say.
I do. I think it probably has rubbed a good amount of people the wrong way. And, you know, it's tough because the week after, everybody wants the swan song. They want the story to keep on going, and him playing bad, now it kind of discredits his big week. And I don't want that to be the case. I think what he did at Oak Hill was tremendous. It was something that we're going to always remember. The fact that he made a hole in one with Rory on the 15th hole coming down the stretch, and he's trying to qualify to get into the PGA the next year. You just can't write it up any better. I will say the interviews, I think by the end, so the things he was saying, it just rubbed a lot of folks that I talked to kind of the wrong way. And, you know, when he got out there and teed it up on Thursday, you know, he played really well in the bright lights, but I think he figured out what these guys face in week in, week out, these stars that have to play in front of the cameras every single week. And guess what? When you're playing bad, there's nowhere to hide. And when I'm sitting there watching him on the back nine, he was doing his best to get through it all, but he had nowhere to hide. Those cameras were not going to leave him. And I've been there before. It's a very lonely place. I know he had a smile on his face, but he's played 26 events on the PGA Tour. I didn't even know that heading into the week. I figured it would have been his first or second start. He's only made two cuts on the tour. And so that changed the storyline a little bit for me, for the fact that he's done this a lot, and not to discredit anything he did. It just, to me, to play on the PGA Tour week in, week out, anybody can have a good week, but let's see what you do the next week. And that's why playing on the PGA Tour is so difficult, is that you have to bring such a high level of play week in, week out.
To zoom out a little bit, because the part of the story that, for me at least, I found alternatively fascinating, amusing, perhaps depressing at times, was just the way that we all reacted to what was happening with Michael Bloch. And I'm not necessarily faulting any network or channel for pursuing a story that was obviously interesting and captivating for the audience that they were trying to serve. But I just wonder what you make of all that we saw in terms of the conversation that was had around Michael Bloch.
What's that famous quote in The Dark Knight Batman?
You either die the hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. I think it was very apt for Michael Bloch this week.
I think I saw that a couple times and I'm thinking, man, we're not too far off there. And Michael seems like a great guy, but it's social media, man. It's 5-6 years ago, if Michael Bloch does this at Oak Hill, who knows if he's built up quite to this extreme that we've seen. The fact that there's been somebody in the PGA Club Professional that has finished better than 15th, they've actually finished 11th, and I don't even know who it is. Did we celebrate it? Probably not. It probably wasn't even a big story. So why was it that big of a story? It's because of all of the media that he did that week, and the story just continued to go and go and go. In this era that we're in now, social media can be very up and down, and he's going to make a lot of money because of the social media hyping him up. But at the same time, the brand showing up in Colonial not playing well, it's hard now because you've just built yourself up to be, wait, this guy can play on the PGA Tour. He can compete with these guys. he even says he can compete with these guys, but it's not easy to hold the media's microphone to say all those things and say them for 30 plus interviews and then have to go put that tee in the ground and realize, oh wait, this game's still pretty hard.
I thought a lot this week of your conversation with Justin Thomas. And by the way, for those who have not listened to that conversation, it's in the feed right now. It's fantastic. And when you get to that spring break section, you can hear a lot of JT's thoughts on social media and the way it's changed in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. But I thought of that because, you know, part of this is, you know, you can't change it back. Like, all you can really do is reminisce and be like, man, I remember the way it was, and I kind of miss that. I just wonder, does our behavior change for Cinderella stories like this in the future? If there's another Michael Block in the future, you know, or are we kind of, is this kind of what it is from now on, you know, of just the, you know, a very polarized reaction to things that happen, and there's no real room for nuance. I mean, because to me, that feels like a pretty depressing reality, and I don't know how we get out of that sort of lane.
Well, as far as golf goes, and what I expect to, if we see a situation like this ever again, I don't think you can recreate what we saw, which is why it was celebrated so much. But as we move forward, I still can't compare it to anything. And I don't know if maybe it's a Monday qualifier, whatever it is. I feel like the PGA Tour is doing is we're going to less players playing in events, the big events, and less of these underdog stories. So celebrate it while we have it, because all we're going to get to watch on TV is really good golf. And it won't be quite as much of some random, you know, 20-year-old or whoever, or just a long journeyman taking down John Rahm on the 18th hole. That would be a similar type of crazy storyline. I just don't think we're going to see that on the PGA Tour that much moving forward. Now, we very well could. I just don't anticipate it. Does that make sense at all to you?
It makes sense in that we should kind of appreciate what the story is for what it is. But I think something remains there, you know, and again, I'm not calling out any media entity or television network specifically, because, you know, they're just doing what they're paid to do oftentimes, or what their passion is doing is, here's something that's happened in the world of golf. You follow me for a reason. I'm here to offer my opinion on it. You know, even the people who took issue with the whole Michael Block scenario, it's like, I found a little bit of irony that people kind of, instead of celebrating Michael Block, saying, well, why are these people tearing this down? It's like, so wait, you're saying that people should be allowed to like what they like, but people who don't like things can't say that they don't like them? You know, that just felt like a little bit interesting to me. So that's all by way of saying is that I feel like whether it's this type of story or something entirely different, the way we seem to have these conversations in today's day and age remains the same. It's very polarized, and maybe I'm just shaking my hand at, you know, like an old man of just like, it's something that's never going to change. But I just wonder how we get to a place where these things don't feel as bad as they do when it's meant to be a uplifting, heartwarming story.
Well, we'll probably see Michael Block again in less than 2 weeks at the RBC Canadian Open. And we'll close the show with a preview of this week's event, the Memorial. But before we get to that, I want to do something a little different this week, and it's only related to golf in the sense that this is how I get to the events I cover. Airports. It's got to be talked about. And what makes an airport a good airport in your opinion? And there's so much different criteria to get into of what people like in certain airports and what people don't like in certain airports, and everybody's so opinionated on it. So why shouldn't we decide what our most important criteria is in an airport?
When I think about an airport, I think about this thing like start to finish. And I don't know if you do this, but I break it down to like, if I'm going to an airport, I'm figuring out what my airline carrier is, and I'm figuring out like, okay, what terminal is that within the airport? And then I'm looking up the parking deck, and I'm looking at like a map of the parking deck as it relates to the airport.
I'm not a map guy.
I am no cartographer either, but at the same time, I will look at that and be like, okay, this is where I need to park my car so that the amount of time that I'm spending walking from that car into the terminal is the shortest amount possible.
Yeah, we're opposites there. I feel it out as I go. And I would say, as far as parking goes, for me, like, an airport has to have, for me to consider it a good airport, the rental car area has to be connected to the airport to where I don't have to hop on one of those stupid buses. It's such a key component. It's like, okay, you get your bags and then you just walk across the street to get your bag or to get your rental car, and you're in your car and you're out of there. That to me makes an airport a good airport. And that's honestly, it sounds terrible, but that's probably one of the highest category, like, criteria things for me on the list. Like, what would be your number one as far as, like, this airport has to have this?
You know, it's almost an intangible, like, parking's a part of it. Like, my biggest, I'm either out on this airport or in on this airport, is how fast can I get through security?
Oh, yeah.
I'm a highly anxious person. Like, and I like
TSA?
I have TSA pre-check. I do.
Okay.
But even that, in certain airports, like, have you ever been to an airport where you're like, you're back timing it out? You're like, if I get here at this time, and by the way, I would like to hear from you on the back end of this, how early you like to arrive at airports? Because I think that's
I can go inside of an hour and feel comfortable.
Wow. But sometimes, okay, so that underscores the point. Sometimes you get to an airport and you're thinking, I'm good with TSA pre-check, and the TSA pre-check line is just as long as a regular line.
I know. It's happening more at the bigger airports. So people that are listening that travel out of New York, LA, this would be their number one, is how long it gets through security for them. Yeah. To me, it's never been an issue. I've never had issue with TSA pre-check. I've never waited more than 15, 20 minutes on a bad day.
Yeah, I think that's a safe. I always try to build in 20 minutes for security. Even if I know it's TSA pre-check and I can breeze through in 2 minutes, then that's just extra time on the back end. But
are you a two-hour guy?
I am not a two-hour guy. Okay. I will say this has changed since my wife and I had our son. Yeah, you got to build in much more time.
That's a different deal, man. Yeah, I'm just saying, if it's just you going.
If it's and there are two things that impact how early I get there. One is obviously my son. Second is, am I checking golf clubs? Because that's the other part of some of these airports where
when you have to take your bag to your golf bag to, like, the oversized thing. Yeah, that's that. I don't like that.
Well, and it's a total cluster because you got to, you know, I wish there was like a manual that came with these airports where you're like, hey, at this airport, even if you pay for your check bag ahead of time, you have to get in that 45 minute line to get your bag tag to get the thing. Because then it's like, okay, well, now I got to add in a lot more time on the front end. Or there have been times this just absolutely drove me nuts one time at RDU, where I showed up and I waited in that whole line. And I got to the end and they're like, oh no, yeah, you could have just gone and printed out your bag tag and walked over to the short little line, and they would have just scanned your bag tag and you could have taken it over to the oversized baggage thing. And I was like, no one thought to, like, tell me that at any point in time. But no one's trying to help you at an airport. Like, you're kind of fending for your own out there.
Yeah. And I will say that as far as wait time, as far as lines go, these sky lounges now, you can wait 20, 30 minutes to get into one of these. They're way overpopulated now.
Are you a sky lounge guy?
I am a sky lounge guy.
That's so nice.
Humble brag.
I'm not. And I'm not, and I'm so envious.
Well, it's all depending on what day of the week you're traveling, what time of the day you're traveling. You know, if you're going a Monday morning, those sky lounges are going to be, the line's going to be long, and it's going to be so many people in there, you can't even find a place to sit. Those things have gotten way too overcrowded. But if I don't have enough time to go to the Sky Lounge, the other criteria that I would say is of utmost importance to me,
okay,
is what is the food situation in the airport? Specifically, do they have a Chick-fil-A?
That's interesting. Cause like, I'm my goal is to get in and out of the airport as fast as possible, but not to the degree where it's going to make me anxious. And so with that in mind, would it be nice if I have a little bit of extra time and I can sit down, like have a bite to eat or, you know, have a coffee, have a beer? Absolutely. But it's not like a make or break thing. It's like if I get there and all I can do is go to that like generic place where they upcharge you 200% on all the items and get like a bottle of water or Powerade, it's like, okay, cool, I'll do it. Fine. You know, it's like not the end of the world for me.
Are you the guy that stands when they say we're boarding in 10, 15 minutes? Are you the guy already standing there?
Not really, man. Yeah, this is,
I know, like, right? Sound like you're the guy standing there. I don't get up until my thing's called. I sit until the end. But there's always that group of 12 dudes that are sitting there ready to rock.
Don't you worry about overhead space at all?
Nah, man, I ain't worried about that. We're all getting on that dang plane. Most of the time I just have my backpack. I've just started bringing a carry-on on just a 1 week Golf Channel show. And I'm just like, whatever. I kind of want to sum up the airport.
Yes.
Criteria. It seems that we settled in on that for you, security lines are important. That would be probably close to number one, and figuring out if parking situation is, because you're a guy that likes to have everything point A to point B. So you're a guy that goes, you plan it all out. You got to be parked close. So if the parking's a bad situation, then the security. And then from there, is there an issue after security line or no?
We're nominally a golf podcast here. We talk a lot about, you know, strokes gained, things like that. I'm minutes gained parking through security. So that encompasses where can I park? How long is it going to take me to get into the terminal? What does my check-in process look like, both for if I just have carry-on bags, but if also have to check bags? What does that security line look like, the amount of time it gets me to get through there? Once I make it through security, big exhale. You could have anything. You could have no food, all the food in the world, anything. Like, it doesn't matter. It's like, I'm through, and as long as you can get me on that flight and it's going to take off, we're going to get home, I'm great.
You start from the beginning. I start from the end. I start with the rental car being connected to the airport. And then I go back to, am I at an airport that typically has delays? And then I go back from there is, what am I eating at the airport? So that, to me, we're on different experiences.
If we travel together, we'd have it all covered. I can do all the front end.
That's a hell of a four ball right there, man. I've got it all dialed from start to finish.
It's a ham and egg travel combo. Yeah. I like it.
Ooh, one other thing.
Yeah.
It's all coming to me.
Yeah.
Charger ports. That is so important to me. Charging ports is so important.
In the airport
and on the plane.
On the plane.
And they never work on the plane.
Never.
And it's so frustrating. When you get one that works on a plane, you're like, oh, man, this is some good stuff here. This is a dang good plane. The other thing you got to think of, I don't really, it's not a big factor for me, but some people feel very strongly about restrooms in an airport, if they're clean or not, or just, I typically don't ever really, I go to the restroom at an airport, I stay away from them, but some people, it's something that they can't miss it. So I've talked to a couple people, they said restrooms is important, but it was not a factor for me. I didn't really care.
I automatically assume every airport restroom is going to be an absolute cesspool, and it just start work from there. Like
expectations are low.
Yeah. If you're operating above cesspool, fantastic. I'm probably going to look back on your restroom fondly. But most of the time you go in there, it's like every stall is occupied by some guy who's been sitting in there for 35 minutes. The place smells absolutely awful. And you're like, how can I just get in and out of this place as fast as humanly possible?
I think we covered most. I guarantee you, I'm going to be flying tomorrow night, and I'm going to be thinking about, there's something that I miss. If you're listening to this podcast, can you please tweet at me or Charlie and let us know if we missed anything? Because I think everybody has their own experiences at the airports, that what is important to them, what's not important to them, what their favorite airport is, what's not. I know my favorite, we didn't really get into what your favorite airport is of all time. Mine's, I'm going to go with either Minneapolis, St. Paul Airport. It's one of my favorites, or really like Detroit too. Those are two of my favorites.
That's interesting. I don't think I've been in either of those airports that I can recall, but I will give two shout outs to airports that that I think are worth noting. One is, I think people make out LaGuardia to be a lot worse than it actually
it's
is.
It's better now.
I think LaGuardia is a fantastic airport, and they They redid it in a lot of areas, but even before, I mean, maybe that was because where I was living in New York, I could get there in like 15 minutes, and it was just like great.
I mean, before they redid that, the Delta one, it was kind of, it was pretty grungy, man. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that's the best take in the world, but they did just spend a bunch of money, and it's really, I think it's way better than it used to be.
Well, and the other one is I would like to shout out, the Hattiesburg, Mississippi airport. That is one of the most quaint, just delightful little airports.
And least favorites?
Ooh. That's a great question. What's the one in Newark? I feel like it's a terrible airport.
It's not good.
That security scene is brutal.
I don't love L.A.
There's like that one corridor of LAX that I feel like everyone has to go to fly cross country. It's maybe the worst place on earth. Miami can be a mess.
The walk between terminals can take 20 to 25 minutes at times, and I don't like Charlotte. I don't know.
Charlotte has the rocking chairs though, man. Big rocking chairs of the window.
One airport that I think is a little underwhelming considering the size of how popular the city is Nashville. I don't think that airport is as nice as what kind of the progression of the city is and how much travel they get. I would say Nashville's a little underwhelming as far as just, it's not really as nice of an air. And they may have changed it since I've been there, but I wasn't impressed.
I've never even been to Nashville, and so therefore I've not flown into Nashville. Maybe, who knows, maybe fall installment of the Oahali Bucket Club. I hope I said that right. Yeah. We might be there. If you need a caddy, I'm great at carrying a wedge, man. One wedge, I'll make sure that thing is as clean as it could possibly be.
Let's go. The only thing I'm going to leave you with on airports, I just want you to do some research on the conspiracy theories with the Denver airport.
It's my favorite. I'm so glad you brought this up. It's my favorite conspiracy theory that exists. Because
it's nuts.
It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. And I remember walking. I remember the thing that stood out to me before I knew about the conspiracy theory is walking through the section where there's like that New World Order mural of sorts. You know, like an insane mural. And I just remember thinking, I'm all for commissioning the arts and things that are, you know, that add artistic value, but like this seems like a strange thing to put in an airport.
Yeah, no, there's some fishy stuff going on at the Denver airport.
we got to dig underneath that airport. There's something underneath that airport.
Yeah,
that's all I'm gonna say. Do your research.
Yeah, no, I'm just gonna leave you with that. If you've never heard of the conspiracy theories with the Denver airport, it's interesting.
Well, Smiley, that was a fairly robust discussion covering lots of airport topics. And, of course, that won't be the last you'll hear on this because you'll have lots of travel the rest of this year covering events both domestic and international. So we look forward to updates from all of those various airports that you land in. But
absolutely.
We got to get to the next event on the schedule, which is another designated event on the PGA Tour, and it is the Memorial Muirfield Village. And so this week we've got 15 of the top 20 in the official world golf rankings in the field. And that number is even skewed a little bit because really the only healthy PGA Tour members that are skipping it are Max Homa and Tony Finau. So just starting off there, what are you most looking forward to this week at this venue?
Well, it was the event I always looked forward to as a player. When people would ask me, what was your favorite PGA Tour event? And you couldn't say the Masters. I said, obviously the Masters, you know, is a major. So they said, what's your favorite PGA Tour event? And I would say the Memorial. It was always my favorite event to play. The reason being, I loved the golf course. I felt like you had to play it with such creativity and had to hit so many different types of shots. And to me, it just fit my eye, and I played it, seemed to always play it pretty well. And it's a big ballpark. It's got this big, you know, big tournament feel to it when you show up, and it was very easy to get up for. The crowds were always amazing. The golf course was in perfect shape, and it's cool because it's Jack's place, and
The locker room, I tell you, that is like one of the best locker rooms that we had all year. Just incredible that it was a place that the breakfast, lunch, and dinner, like you could eat any meal there. So that was unusual. Only a few events had that option, and Memorial was one of them. So they treated you great. And then everybody always talks about the milkshakes, man. That made your bad rounds manageable and your good rounds even better.
Let's just go right to the milkshakes. Let's be honest. This is what the people want to hear about. Just tell me, I have so many questions, but let's begin with, explain the milkshake itself. Is it a Buckeye milkshake, like a chocolate peanut butter type of thing?
Yeah, that's normally what I would get. That was the most popular selection.
The other part of this that fascinates me is there are so many tour players, of course, that have these regimented diets, and they're, you know, like JT's a great example coming into this year of like,
he's gonna be so mad.
I'm gluten-free, no alcohol, this and that. Did you see guys that week who you knew to be very strict about diets say, you know what, I'll have like a milkshake or two because it's Jack's place?
You know what, when I was playing, I didn't really ever hear about too many diets because typically tour players, they burn so many calories, and nothing like a milkshake before a afternoon practice session after you play in the morning. We would go eat, get a milkshake, then go practice. And or, you know, just when you finish your day, you're just like, all right, how many milkshakes we taking back to whoever? And that's kind of how we finish our days. It was they were amazing. I love milkshakes so much, and those milkshakes are 10 out of 10.
You gotta love that. Back to the course a little bit. It's Jack's place, and it's undergone a variety of different, you know, changes, renovations over the year. And Jack has kind of termed it in 2020 was his last bite of the apple, the last kind of renovation, you know, that he was going to do, and, you know, did a lot to, you know, the green complexes and some of the bunkering. And so, you know, what do you make of this most recent set of changes he made in 2020 and the way the golf course plays now?
So I have talked to some players about the changes at Muirfield, and I would say that they were, you know, kind of not their favorite renovations, and some of them were kind of confusing of why they made certain changes to certain holes. And I haven't seen it yet, so it's hard for me to give you my opinion on it, but I know a lot of players have been a little confused by some of the changes. It just doesn't really make sense to them. So that's one thing. You have to wonder moving forward is if the golf course is frustrating for guys to play, or is it going to continue to get this crazy good feel that we continue to see? But it is Jack's place. It's a place that so many people show up and get up for. I do know that 16th hole, I always thought that one was so, so bad. It was so firm, and you could not hold that left side of the green. And when they put the pin, especially in the front, that right bunker was absolute jail. You couldn't do anything. So we were hitting shots that couldn't hold the front of the green to the front pin. So you can't get it close to that pin. And if you did, you really hit a heck of a shot. But then that left pin, you're trying to hit it as close to the edge of the water. I don't know what it's like now or what it looks like, but there's a lot of questionable shots out there now that I think guys wish it was just the original. That is all for this episode of The Smiley Show. We have a big interview hitting the feed on Thursday that you will not want to miss. And to get caught up before then, head over now to download Conversations with Justin Thomas, Sam Burns, and Jake Owen. Thanks for listening, and see you then. The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.